This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll explore the complicated feelings some people have about a return to normalcy.
Now we're going to a place where we are going to be 100% responsible for what's taking place in our lives, and we've gone 15 months without that.
Also, you'll hear from a resident about what it's like to live in a city center.
The downtown definitely goes through phases during the day. Around 11 o'clock is the witching hour. All of a sudden, it'll go from a downtown with a bunch of restaurants to hip-hop central with lots of music and lots of people out on the streets.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 17th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Following a landmark decision by the California Coastal Commission to phase out off-highway vehicular use at Oceano Dunes, nonprofit Friends of Oceano Dunes has filed three lawsuits against the commission. KCBX contributor Sophie Lincoln has more.
If successful, the lawsuit would reverse the Coastal Commission's decision and provide damages to the affected organizations, including Friends of Oceano Dunes. The first lawsuit alleges that the commission violated the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, by failing to study the environmental impacts of the decision. President and founder of Friends of Oceano Dunes, Jim Sudi, says that the Coastal Commission did not follow the due process of CEQA review in its performance of the permit review on March 18th.
I think if the Coastal Commission did everything properly, they would have been able to complete the review and then have a more informed discussion with the commissioners at that hearing.
According to the Coastal Commission's Central Coast District Supervisor, Kevin Kahn, the commission did actually release a staff report, including environmental analysis, to the public 30 days prior to the hearing. This is well ahead of the CEQA requirement, which is 10 days prior to a hearing. The second lawsuit, made by Friends of Oceano Dunes, alleges that the Coastal Commission exceeded its authority under the California Coastal Act and the statutes and policies that govern state parks. Sudi says the Coastal Act does not allow the Coastal Commission to override the authority of another state agency, which Sudi says is what the commission is trying to do. Under Section 30106 of the Coastal Act, development is broadly defined to include various physical developments, including any change in the intensity of use of land. According to Kahn, all changes in development require a coastal development permit, which is then reviewed based on coastal resource management policies listed in the Coastal Act.
The overall tenor or gist of them is to protect and enhance coastal resources. In addition to private parties, it also applies to other state agencies, so state parks.
The third lawsuit alleges that under state law, no agency, including the Coastal Commission, can prohibit off-roading vehicles at the dunes due to an implied dedication for vehicular use that existed before the property was owned by the public. Sudi says that more lawsuits will soon be filed against the Coastal Commission's decision. Other concerns of Sudi's that may show up in these lawsuits include accessibility for disabled individuals and the economic impact of the decision. Sudi says that phasing out vehicular use on the dunes will prevent disabled people from accessing the beach.
This is the only park, the only beach in all of California that you could drive out and enjoy not only the water, the surf, but go through the dunes when you're disabled or handicapped.
Kahn says that the commission has heard the concerns for disabled individuals, which played a role in their recommendation to continue to allow for vehicular access and car camping on the less sensitive portion of the beach on West Grand and Pier Avenues.
There's almost a mile and a half stretch of beach that will remain open and available for vehicle access and camping. And so people who, you know, access the beach because of disability issues via their car will continue to be able to do that.
In terms of the economic impact, Sudi says that based on a similar decision to prohibit vehicular access at Guadalupe Dunes, he thinks it is unlikely that the beach will maintain the same level of economic activity after vehicular access has been restricted.
Let's analyze the town of Guadalupe to the south of the park. They were told in 1982, when the dunes would be closed off, that they would get all this ecotourism. It hasn't happened. It failed.
Khan, on the other hand, argues that the economic impact may not be so negative, especially considering potential other users that might be more likely to visit the beach once vehicular access is restricted. For KCBX News, I'm Sophie Lincoln.
A Walk for Kristen Smart is being held to commemorate the anniversary of her death. Kristen Smart, a 19-year-old Cal Poly student, went missing after she left an off-campus party in San Luis Obispo on May 25, 1996. KCBX contributor Tessa Hughes has more.
The walk follows the route Smart is believed to have taken before her disappearance from the house she left on Crandall Way all the way back to her dorm at Cal Poly. Most events that have been held in the past for Smart have been held in North San Luis Obispo County, since that is closer to the Smart family. However, this event is being held here as a way to be accessible to Cal Poly students. Cal Poly student Elle Larson is excited to bring awareness to her peers.
A lot of the events have been, you know, up in North County, and that's really hard for a lot of students to get to. And so this one will allow more students to be part of it. It's really going to allow some people who've never heard of her or have never seen her, they're going to be able to see who she is, and maybe it'll get more people interested in her case.
Not only is this event serving to raise awareness around Smart's case, but Larson says it is a reminder of what happened to Smart herself.
It also always makes me a little sad when I talk about Kristen, because I look around and see that it could happen to me, it could happen to any of my friends.
The walk's organizer, Tessa Wachowski, is hoping the walk will raise awareness for student safety as well.
The point of the walk is not only to honor Kristen, but also just to bring awareness of safety and just to promote the buddy system.
Wachowski is hosting the walk because she feels she relates to Smart.
Like, I'm also just a beach girl. I come from San Diego, so I relate to her on that level. And I really just want to help her case and just help her parents find closure.
Relating to Smart is a large reason many students are ready to attend the event, such as Cuesta College student Alondra Pizon Betacourt.
I understand that some justice is being served at the moment. However, during this entire case, I have kept in mind how Kristen Smart was a student just like everybody is. She had this idea that she's going to move to this town, she was going to further her education, and it's just very upsetting.
Paul and Ruben Flores were recently arrested for their suspected role in Kristen Smart's disappearance. Paul Flores was charged with first-degree murder and is being held without bail. Ruben Flores, Paul's father, is being charged with being an accessory to the crime and was released on bail. Cal Poly student Nishant Narayan says the walk is his way of showing solidarity to the new judicial proceedings surrounding the case.
I know that in this community there's been a lot of kind of collective pain around the case and the injustices around it. And I think it's just a very good way to show solidarity and support, especially in the wake of the judicial proceedings that are going on right now.
Wachowski hopes that this walk will maintain the community's momentum and support for Smart's case.
There's been a lot of breaks in the case and a lot of new evidence has been found. There's moments of silence in the case while authorities are figuring out what's going on, and some people lose hope, but it's just a really good idea to, you know, keep her name out there.
The Walk for Kristen Smart is being held Tuesday, May 25th at 6:30 p.m., starting at Crandall Way in San Luis Obispo. For KCBX News, I'm Tessa Hughes.
Last Thursday, the CDC announced something that many have been waiting for permission for fully vaccinated people to take off their masks in most settings. It was presented as a significant step toward normalcy. But when it comes to getting back to normal, many people's feelings are complicated. KVPR's Kathleen Schock had a conversation with mental health professionals Atisha Wilbon, Vice President of Mental Health Systems, Inc., and Leah Whitworth, Behavioral Health Manager at Kaiser Permanente, and Henry Meraz, Owner and Clinical Director of Safe and Affirmative Counseling.
So I have spent the last, you know, year plus daydreaming about, you know, all the things that we weren't able to do, hanging out with my friends and going out to dinner and going to see live music. And as I dreamed about doing those things, I guess I just assumed that my reaction to that would be joy and bliss and all positive. And then I got vaccinated. And then my friends became fully vaccinated. And now I find myself in a situation where, as I'm slowly reintroducing these activities into my life, what I've found is that it's great, but it's also weird. And, you know, there have been times when I found myself in situations that I should be having the time of my life. But after everything we've been through, I just want to go home. And I kind of miss how small my world used to be. I'm going to go ahead and start with Leah. Is this normal, or is this something you're hearing from other folks?
Yes. What you've described right there, absolutely. A typical response. We've been through so much this past year, going from, you know, our regular busy lives to quarantine, lockdown, and we adjusted to that new lifestyle. And now with vaccination and, you know, California slowly reopening and set to go a little bit faster next month, now we're being catapulted back into life as we knew it and yet still different. Yeah, the fact that you're looking forward to going out and then simultaneously maybe noticing some anxiety from the thoughts about going out, and maybe you're interacting with people who aren't vaccinated and who aren't observing those safety precautions. And so now you're aware of thoughts that you didn't have 15 months ago. So yeah, the anxiety is completely understandable and valid.
I'm wondering if, Atisha, if you could just weigh in, what are your thoughts on all of this?
So I'm definitely in agreement with this, more specifically because we have gotten so used to what our norm looks like. And right now we are coming back to something that is really uncertain. And so especially people that have had a serious impact as a result of COVID, they've lost individuals. Some people have had COVID, and those different things have created PTSD reactions and things along those lines. No one likes to kind of not know what's coming next. Right now, we are all winging it.
Henry Mraz, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
Yeah, so I would agree with everything that's been said so far. And our mind and body really loves this sense of normalcy and routine in some weird way, even though we all wanted to kind of go back to things being the way it was before. We kind of adapted, you know, to the way things are and the way they have been over the last year. So going out into the world, adjust and adapt all over again, and our mind and body's like, no, like, it's not safe yet. Everybody has their own past experiences as well. So those who have trauma in their past, this could be very triggering for them. It could bring them back to a place that they really weren't ready to visit yet, or they weren't ready to go to yet. And so going back out into the world can be much more complicated for some than for others.
Well, I definitely want to hear from you all about what tips you might have on how to manage our social anxiety as we come out of this pandemic. But before we go there, one of the things that I've been hearing people express a fair amount of anxiety about are pants, having to wear pants on a regular basis, and pants not fitting as well as they did, let's say, a year ago. And so I'm wondering, and Leah, we'll come back to you. Can you just talk a bit about sort of body image and self-esteem after going through this period of in some cases, self-isolation?
I think that's a fantastic question and really something that is on the minds of a lot of people. You're absolutely right. You know, this past year, working from home, maybe you were on your Zoom meetings or your Zoom calls and you're dressed to the gills, you know, from the waist up, and down below you're wearing your sweatpants and your Uggs. And I know, right. I could say I have done that from time to time myself. And just going with that over the past year and how we've maybe in a sense let our guard down in terms of being vigilant about self-care and, you know, maybe exercise. If you were somebody who thrived at the gym and then suddenly your gym was closed, maybe the sadness and disappointment and helplessness of that led to lots of inactivity and extra eating. Who knows? And so now here we are trying to get back into our lives and, yes, facing some of the fallout or the consequences, if you will, of self-medicating for that sadness, depression, and anxiety of the past year. what I would encourage and do encourage patients I work with at Kaiser is just to, number one, identify how you feel, notice the feelings, and validate them and separate them. Separate them from what's the actual problem. If the actual problem is that you've put on some weight, then just notice you've put on some weight. Are you satisfied or unsatisfied with it? No, I'm not satisfied with it. Okay. Rather than beating yourself up, judging yourself harshly, notice the feeling of unsatisfaction, dissatisfaction, and then go solve for the problem. Be mindful about what you're putting in your mouth. Be mindful about the amount of movement that you're bringing to your body each day. Whatever it takes, solve for the problem. Feel the feelings, solve for the problem. And notice the urge to just sit, push past it, and go get busy. And then notice how you feel. You feel powerful. You feel skillful. You feel accomplished. Those are feelings that we really want to notice and work to reproduce.
Henry Meraz, I'd like to direct the next question at you. So earlier in the pandemic, we had a guest on the show who talked about how the stay-at-home orders were particularly impacting LGBTQ college students that were forced to leave campus and go back home into living situations where, in some cases, they could not be as open about their sexuality and their identity. And it got me thinking about some of the ways in which the pandemic has uniquely impacted the LGBTQ community. You specialize in working with LGBTQ clients. What could you say about that?
A lot of the people that I work with and that I meet with every day are a part of the LGBT community. And it's a big struggle for a lot of it, especially younger people who are still financially dependent on their parents and their families. They may have been living this thriving life of being out, of being open, of being their authentic, genuine self, and suddenly almost being forced back into the closet, you know? And maybe if they were out, not feeling safe at home. So a lot of people have actually had severe symptoms in terms of being back at home or being kind of locked up again. You know, you're back in that scary space where you work so hard to get out of. A lot of my clients, especially people that are like transgender, for them, it's really scary going out in the world. And so for some of them, it had the opposite effect, where if they are on their own, it's actually been comforting to be able to, like, safely be using the bathroom at home and not being judged by the outside world. So it's been a really mixed response. But I will say younger, you know, individuals who are going home from college and more dependent on their families, it's been very triggering for them. And they're just kind of eager to go back to school. They're eager to get back to their, you know, kind of regular lives. But, yeah, it's been kind of a mixed bag. I will say some clients actually prefer, especially imagine a high schooler who's bullied at school for being gay or for being, you know, bi or for being pan or like transgender. They're at home now and maybe their parents are supportive and they're safer at home and they like online school and they don't have to worry about the bathroom or being bullied or being misgendered or someone using the wrong pronouns or using the wrong name for them. So they suddenly feel a lot of those people are doing better right now and they're scared to go back. So it's almost like this mixed bag in terms of what's your home life like if you're a part of the LGBT community.
That's such a good point. It reminds me of how individually we have experienced this collective moment. You know, it's really been so different for all of us. So let's get back to what advice you all have on managing social anxiety as we come out of the pandemic. Atisha, let's start with you. What tips do you have for folks?
I think for the most part is to make sure that we're not having high expectations of ourselves and not saying I should be doing this. There are going to be some people that the moment that things are fully open and it's time to, you know, be able to go back and do all these things in person, they're going to jump at that opportunity. And if you feel that level of ambivalence and that anxiety, giving yourself permission to feel that, and it's okay that you may not be as ready as others, and not allowing that to dictate how you decide to move within the world.
Henry, how would you follow up on that?
I would agree. I think it's great to say, you know, to not be too hard on ourselves. I always work a lot on self-compassion. You know, I always say, you know, cutting yourself some slack, you know, give yourself a break. It's a huge change right now. And we're kind of springing back into things. And so I think a little bit of self-love, self-compassion, and just allowing yourself some time to transition back into things, you know, and taking it easy and it's okay to be not sure or to struggle a little bit and allow yourself to kind of feel those things. Just, you know, little by little, your body and your mind will start to adjust, but it will be hard at first. And we don't want to add more stress. We've already been stressed for a year, you know?
And Leah, what tips do you have?
Well, the passion for getting back to life is huge, I think, for many people. And then there are those people who are frightened and anxious. The unknown is scary. Notice your thoughts. Notice your feelings. If you're feeling anxious and concerned about getting back out there at the same pace that your family and friends are, notice that you're judging yourself as somehow you should be doing something different. Let go of the should. Let go of the should. To me, I always think about shoulds when we use a should about ourselves. What we're really going for right there is blame, shame, guilt, and fault. Henry mentioned self-compassion. Absolutely. Atisha mentioned grace at one point earlier. I would say absolutely, absolutely, absolutely to each of those. Be patient and kind and loving with yourself. Know that you've come through a tremendous storm this past year, and the patience to step back, you know, stop is a skill we also teach in the program I run. The stop skill says stop, take a step back, take a breath, observe what's going on around you. I like to throw in, check the facts, notice what you're in control of and what you're not in control of. You're always in control of yourself, for starters. You can't control anybody else or any situation. You can control yourself and your responses to situations. And then proceed mindfully. So STOP, stop, take a step back, observe, and proceed mindfully. And as I mentioned earlier, the skill of opposite action. When you notice that you are feeling anxious and afraid, the action urge for those feelings is to avoid and escape. You really don't ultimately want to be an avoider and an escaper, then you notice this and you challenge yourself to do the opposite, which is to get a little bit active, to get out there and engage. And then again, notice how you feel after you make yourself do that. Notice that you feel proud. Notice that you feel happy. Notice that you feel empowered. And these are some things that I'm working on with our patients over at Kaiser.
Well, this has been an absolutely affirming conversation, and I appreciate all of you taking the time to bring a little bit of calm to what I think so many of us are experiencing. I've been talking to Henry Mraz, owner and clinical director of Safe and Affirmative Counseling, Atisha Wilbon, vice president of Mental Health Systems Incorporated, and Leah Whitworth, behavioral health manager for Kaiser Permanente Fresno. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That was KVPR's Kathleen Schock. Up next on Around Downtown, we'll take a look at the issues affecting our city centers from the perspective of downtown residents.
For Issues and Ideas, this is Bettina Swigger with our monthly segment called Around Downtown. On today's episode, we're going to hear from two local residents in the downtown to get their perspective on what it's like to live near our city center in San Luis Obispo. Thanks so much for being with me today, Garrett and Susan Olson.
Hi, Bettina.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Garrett, let's start off with you. How long have you lived in San Luis Obispo, and how close do you live to downtown?
So we've been here since August of 2012. We live just three streets off of the downtown, and we absolutely love being here. This is our adopted home. We moved here, particularly to where we are now. A lot of it was driven by our amazing, vibrant downtown.
Both of you currently work in the nonprofit sector, but when you originally came to the community, what brought you to San Luis Obispo and to downtown specifically?
So in July of 2012, I was the fire chief in the city of Scottsdale, Arizona, and the then current police chief had actually been a friend of mine. He'd worked as a police commander in Scottsdale before coming here to be the police chief, Steve Gazelle. And there was a vacancy in the organization and a new position in the organization. And Chief Gazelle reached out and asked me if I was interested, and I said no. And like without even batting an eye, I had just an amazing career in Scottsdale. And it was just a, a beautiful place for our family. We raised our son there. Career trajectory and friend group and everything in Arizona was just so well established. And then about 5 months later, he called me again and I was in my office and he said, hey, why don't you just come out and visit? It was almost like it was a timeshare thing. He was just trying to sucker me out here to give me this spiel. And I'd never visited San Luis Obispo before. So I quickly pulled it up and saw that the weather here was 74 degrees and it was exactly 114 in Scottsdale. And I said, well, okay, maybe we'll come and visit you. All the while thinking we were going to come and visit and escape the heat, but never thinking I'm going to accept this job. It's a smaller community. It's in California, which is far more expensive than Arizona to live. And we just thought, well, we're just going to go visit. So much so that when the city offered to fly us out and put us up, I still care very deeply about how every tax dollar is sent. And I felt like we were coming out here to escape the heat and I wasn't going to let the city of San Luis Obispo taxpayers pay for our trip out here. So we drove out and we stayed at the police chief's house. And lo and behold, we came out on a Wednesday evening. And then the next day, we got the tour of the surrounding area. And it culminated with parking not far from where we live right now and walking up to the downtown on a Thursday night at Farmers Market. And our point of reference on quote unquote farmers market is based on every other farmers market we've seen. My parents live in a beautiful town up in Washington State. Their farmers market is a guy selling radishes and another guy selling flowers he cut out of his garden. So
that's not quite true. It's a nice farmers market, but nothing like Slows.
But you get the point. And I can remember us walking and as we were approaching Higuera from the south side of the city, hearing the music and smelling the tri-tip and seeing all of the people. And I turned to our escorts and said, hey, remind me, do you do this once a week or once a year? It looked like something that would happen once a year. It was just the scale of it was just mind blowing. And we turned the street right there at Moro and Higuera, which now is three streets up from us. And we saw the lighted trees, all the happy people and bands and food and radishes and flowers and everything else. It was just, it literally struck us as this is the kind of place that we dream of going on vacation. And to think that we could actually move to this amazing, vibrant, active place just blew our minds. And I can remember Sue walking next to me as we turned the corner and we're looking at Farmers Market. And literally every conversation we'd had up until then is, how do we tell these people I'm not going to accept the job and be kind about it? And Susan looked at me as she's squeezing my hand like she's milking a cow. And she very quietly says, we need to make this work. We need to figure this out. I'm like, really? And so literally the next day, I accepted the job offer from city manager Katie Lichtig. That Sunday, we put a bid in on the house that we live in now. And been thrilled, like literally every single day, we are so thrilled to live here. And just about every single day, we walk through our downtown and we smile and look around.
And when we would go on vacation, we always liked to stay in little towns and we'd stay in a bed and breakfast and we enjoyed being able to walk to the shops and the restaurants and little movie theaters and everything. And, you know, always had to go home then where we didn't have all of that. And so that was one of the reasons that your downtown that Thursday night just sold us, because that's what we enjoy, you know, and just the thought that that could be our life was.
It has all of the wonderful things of these little communities we've vacationed in, but still all of the resources of larger communities that we've lived in. For us, it's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. This is the porridge that's just perfect for us.
The pandemic notwithstanding, what are some of the changes that you've observed living so close to downtown for the last 8 years?
We've seen a lot of incredible growth, the timing of which some of that has been tragic with the pandemic. Super, super excited for the two beautiful hotels that moved in right before the pandemic. As much as we love having people come and stay with us, we're in a pretty small house. We were excited to be able to have people come and visit us, have more options for them to stay. We see ebbs and flows in the homeless population. That's a really, really challenging social issue. I know from my years in the fire service before San Luis Obispo, and really since moving here, just what an incredible challenge that is for the state of California, for local communities. It's not a one solution issue. And unfortunately, a lot of folks stand at polar ends of that social issue and yell at each other, when really I believe the solution is somewhere in the middle of recognizing that there isn't one cause for homelessness, which means there isn't one solution for homelessness. But we've really seen some ebbs and flows. We live pretty close to Mitchell Park. There will be runs during the month, several months long, where Mitchell Park will look like, a Red Cross refugee camp with tents and people all over. And then by whatever response, either supportive or corrective, then it'll be cleared out for a while, and then it'll come back. And it's probably one of the most significant challenging issues we see on a daily basis. Susan works for Hospice of SLO County, and her office is the other side of Mitchell Park. And so most days she walks to work. And so most days she sees what's happening there. And it's the people that are making you feel uncomfortable, whether it's by their presence or more typically by their behavior, need help. Our county needs to do something more about that. It's really, really tragic. Again, very complex. But ignoring it isn't making it go away. And I know we're not ignoring it, but doing the same thing we've been doing on and on and on also isn't making it go away.
And this isn't just a problem that we're having here on the Central Coast. This is a statewide problem. This is a national problem. And the pandemic has certainly exacerbated it.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Bettina Swigger of San Luis Obispo's Downtown Association is speaking with Garrett and Susan Olson, who live downtown.
Are there any other behaviors that you've seen downtown that have maybe had a less positive effect on your daily life? There's a big nightlife scene. We live in a college town. Do you?
So we walk our dog every night, and more often than not, we'll walk through the downtown because he loves being a Roomba to the downtown and picking up all the food that's left behind that he can get before we pull him back. The downtown definitely goes through phases during the day, certainly Thursday through Saturday, pre-pandemic, and now we're starting to see more of that again, which is good. We're not NIMBYs. We moved here and there was an active downtown. We moved here and knew that Cal Poly students were here, and sometimes they do silly, destructive, dangerous things. Around 11 o'clock is the witching hour. All of a sudden it'll go from a downtown with a bunch of restaurants to all of a sudden hip hop central, and with lots of music and lots of people out on the streets. We're a college town. That's what you get. And, we were once not gray haired and in college. And if we lived in San Luis Obispo, I think we would absolutely love to come here and spend our nights in the downtown. I really look at Cal Poly, and I think Cal Poly and Questa are a big influence on the transition of the downtown at night. I look at them and I am thankful for the stabilizing effect that they have on our local economy. If not for those 20 plus thousand students coming here and bringing someone, in some cases, mom and dad's money, and in some cases their own, our local economy would go through ebbs and flows that other economies in California realize to a much greater degree. And so I'm kind of a realist, and I see people behaving in a way that I think, that's just not really cool. I look at it on the whole and think, is it worth getting rid of all of the good that comes from, a couple of bad actors to change the character of our town? We moved here eyes wide open, knowing that the community we moved into, we knew there's a homeless issue in California. We know that this is a college town. We know that we live in a super old house that's going to be really expensive to maintain. All of those things, we moved here eyes wide open. And so we're believe it or not, we're just pretty positive, optimistic people. It's not that we don't see the issues, but we really try and consider them in the spectrum of all that exists and all that is available to us here in this beautiful community.
And when we moved here, I remember somebody said, why would you want to live downtown? You know, and somebody else said, oh, you'll get tired of going to that Thursday market. You'll stop going, you know, that
never.
You're just in the honeymoon stage. But we've gone to that Thursday night market every Thursday night since we've moved here, unless we're out of town, you know, or some other obligation. But most of the time we go, and we would always get our pizza from Giuseppe's Pizza Oven, and we would take it down to Lewis Wine Bar, and everybody always knew that that's where we'd be on Thursday night. And we'd always have a group of friends that would show up, and we have absolutely loved it every Thursday.
it's super vibrant. And it's exciting. I mean, it's fun for us to just participate and in some cases just watch humanity go by. The first farmer's market that opened, I believe it was May 6th, we were there, masks on, buying kale and just smiling at all of the people that were there that clearly were not there for update their produce selection in the refrigerator. They were there just to be with people and to feel that sense of community. And it was lovely. So yeah, that's we absolutely love the downtown. Even with some of its warts, overall, it is perfect for us.
Well, I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago about the economy of downtown, because that's something that, of course, is of great interest right now. And in my role as the CEO of the Downtown Association, in addition to being the KCBX radio host, I'm frequently in conversations with other leaders in downtowns who are dealing with tall skyscrapers full of offices that have been abandoned by office workers. And we don't necessarily have that problem here on the Central Coast because we have smaller communities without those types of urban office communities. But we do see a healthy economy with students from Cuesta and Cal Poly who work in the shops and at the restaurants, with tourism coming back. How do you see the economy rebounding? And how do you think that will affect you as residents of the downtown?
I'll start with how it's going to impact us. It's going to be a lot harder to park soon.
Parking, yes,
yeah.
The topic.
We live in the first block that doesn't have metered parking off the downtown. And so finding a spot, and we have a tiny little 100-year-old one-car garage and two cars. Mm-hmm. And so parking is an issue and continues to be an issue. Again, we moved here knowing we had a one-car garage and two cars, and we live close to the downtown. So we're not going to city council meetings, jumping up and down, screaming about parking. It would be nice if there was a better solution for parking. It would be nice for our environment if less people were motoring around the downtown. I think there are some examples of other communities with really brilliant combination of parking, remote parking lots, and then low emission vehicles that'll bring people to the downtown. When the city was looking at its transportation plan for the downtown, I was a big fan of, and this is probably going to be super controversial, I was a big fan of considering closing Hygera to traffic and just putting a lane down the middle for emergency access as a former fire chief, but also for a trolley, electric trolley, that could take people back and forth to their vehicles, and then move the shops out into the streets, kind of like we're seeing now during the pandemic and very much like you see in Europe. And I guess that brings me back to what do I see? What I see is a community that's engaged, that has a lot of dialogue and is really smart about things and not afraid to take chances. I think we've got the city manager at the helm that we need. I had an opportunity to work with Derek, and he has just an amazing team. He is incredibly well-read and well-studied, and he's collaborative. And so I'm excited to see what the Downtown Association, the Chamber of Commerce, the city, the local businesses do to reinvent our town as we emerge from what has been, the most tragic year, certainly in our lifetime.
What do you think about the planned projects that are going in that are going to bring more housing to the downtown? If we look at how neighborhood trends have been over the last 50, 60 years, there used to be a higher concentration of people who actually lived in the downtown. What's your opinion about those new projects coming on?
I'd love to see that happen. I think it would bring more amenities to the downtown. You know, it'd be amazing to have a grocery store, even if it was a small one, in the downtown area. I think having more people there at all hours of the day will make the downtown a little bit safer. You know, more eyes will create less negative behaviors in the downtown. I think it brings some vibrancy back. I think it could have the impact of stabilizing the downtown economy so that you're not always relying on the school year for some of the activities that you have. And whether it's the bars or the coffee shops, if you've got people that live in the downtown, all of those boats are going to rise in a rising tide. We're very concerned about our environment. And if we could have more people living and working in the downtown, and I know that's a challenge because of affordable housing, we don't want to have a whole bunch of jobs that are at minimum wage in the downtown and then build homes that are for people that, you know, can have $2 million to drop on a mortgage. So there needs to be some thoughtfulness in the type of professions that we attract to the downtown and align that with the housing opportunities. I don't know that the downtown is a great place for like super large multifamily dwellings, but I do think that a lot of residential above commercial, there's a lot of opportunity for that in the downtown, and that's very exciting.
Thank you so very much for joining me and giving your perspective on what it's like to live and work and commute and shop and just be a neighbor downtown. I've been speaking with Garrett and Susan Olson for Issues and Ideas. This is Bettina Swigger.
Springtime is kitten season, but the feral cat population creates problems on the Central Coast year-round. A student-run program at Cal Poly State University benefits the cats while preparing students for a future in animal care.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mewks. I am your host. And today we are looking at an issue that is very important to our community. That's working with the cat population. I have today Andrea Berkich. She is the shelter manager and social media coordinator at the Cal Poly Cat Program to tell us all about it. Welcome to the Nonprofit Story, Andrea.
Hi, thank you so much for letting me be here today. I'm so excited to talk about this organization. I've been a part of it for the last 4 years.
You're a student at Cal Poly, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a fourth year animal science major on the pre-veterinary track, and I'm actually graduating this upcoming spring.
Congratulations. Are you going to stay in the field?
Yeah, I will. I'm probably going to end up in shelter medicine.
There tells us a lot about the dedication of people involved with this program. So take us back. Tell us a little bit about the history and mission of the Cal Poly Cat Program.
So the Cal Poly Cat Program started out in 1992 as a senior project by one of the animal science majors on campus. Back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and eventually the 90s, there was a huge overpopulation of feral cats on campus. Most of these animals were either abandoned pets from college students or dumped animals that community members would bring to campus because they knew there were already a lot of cats here. And those cats multiplied, and there would usually be a population of anywhere of 200 to 400 cats. And of course, it would fluctuate given the weather and disease spread. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge animal welfare concern. These animals weren't living a good quality of life. They weren't getting veterinary care. They were frequently being hit by cars. There was a lot of disease. It was really distressing for students as well, just to have a huge feral cat colony outside of their dorms and they constantly find sick and dying cats. And also they were just a nuisance. They were very loud. There would be a lot of cat fighting. Cats would sometimes get into people's dorms. It was just generally considered to be a really bad situation. And so these animal science majors stepped forward and they introduced a program, a TNR program, which stands for Trap, Neuter, Release. And right now it's the most popular feline management program when it comes to overpopulation of feral cats. So these cats would be trapped by volunteers. They'd be taken to the vet where they'd be sterilized. They'd get their vaccines. They'd get dewormed, flea treatment. And then every single cat that went through this program would get what's called an ear tip or an ear notch, where the last 1 to 3 centimeters of one ear gets surgically removed by a veterinarian. And that signifies that this cat doesn't need to be caught again. They got a lot of cats sterilized. And anyone who was friendly, they actually adopted out. And within about 10 to 15 years, the cat population dropped. And now we have about 10 cats on campus, and we haven't had any breeding in about 15 years.
Wow, to have kept it going that long. Usually a project like that won't last as long as something like this on a campus.
They were very dedicated to longevity because TNR isn't a quick solution. You do mm-hmm. it understanding that these cats are then going to live out their natural lives. Mm-hmm. But it actually expanded from there. They had so many cats that needed to be rehomed that they started an entire adoption program. And the adoption program, of course, needed a place to house the cats. So we eventually got a warehouse on campus that we still rent to this day. And we use it as a shelter.
So now you have a home for the cats to stay. And does that shelter also serve as a training program for some of the students in the field?
Oh, absolutely. All of this is focused on student education. Cal Poly has a really strong animal science program. However, there aren't a lot of small animal opportunities. Mm. And the majority of students coming to campus want to work with cats and dogs. So this is a really great place for them to get the experience they need. It's almost completely run and managed by students. However, we do gladly accept community members as well into our program. And it serves as an opportunity for students to really get involved with the community. Now that our campus population has been under control for decades, we moved on to the rest of the community. We work extensively in San Luis Obispo, Atascadero, Paso Robles, where there are a lot of feral cats. And we still do TNR and we teach students how to do it. And students are involved with every aspect of the process. They ask for fundraising. They run our marketing. Mm-hmm. They get the traps. They maintain the traps. They physically trap the cats, do the transportation, work with the vets, book the appointments, do monitoring after surgery, and of course, release. And they're also involved in all aspects of running the shelter itself. The TNR program is just one aspect of what we do, but we also do really extensive fostering and adoption programs. And all of these are student-run. Last spring, we just started a neonatal kitten fostering program. After feral cats, neonatal kittens are the next most euthanized population in municipal shelters.
Wow. And
yeah, this was actually my friend's senior project where uh-huh. she basically herself was able to organize a program where we fundraised money to help pay for the kittens' medical bills. It trained probably close to 50 fosters.
So you're saying that people will work throughout San Luis Obispo County. Do they physically come to the different cities and look for the cats, or do people call you to tell you there's a cat population?
It's a combination of things. Okay. We really work with a lot of different situations and scenarios. A lot of times it'll be like one of our volunteers who happens to live in Atascadero. Other times it's like someone who reaches out to us through social media, or mm-hmm. we'll get an email saying like, I'm overwhelmed with feral cats. I really need help. And we'll work with these people and try to meet them where they're at. We understand that financing this is really difficult. So we do have a fund that we specifically use for paying for spay neuter surgeries.
Okay.
We just basically try to assist in any way that we can. We're also more than happy to spread information. We'll do trainings over Zoom or even in person for trap neuter release. Like if these people are willing to do it themselves, we will give them, you know, the knowledge and the equipment they need to successfully trap, neuter, release the cats on their properties.
That's good to know right there that you will do the training for people. And
yeah,
like you said, you do it for Zoom at this point in case someone needs to do it themselves. Let's get back to the young ones and to the babies.
They are the most fun.
As you were saying, there's a large cat population that's being born at certain periods of time. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that and what people can do, and especially if they're seeing them out and about.
There's a phenomenon that people in animal rescue call kitten season, and it sounds fun, but it's actually terrible. Kitten season lasts a very long time here on the Central Coast because it's so nice and warm here. Kitten season usually lasts March until November. And wow. This is when cats are actively breeding and having kittens. Cats hit sexual maturity quickly and they breed until the end of their lives. And so if you just have a couple of intact cats in an area, you can quickly have a population of 20, 30 animals by the end of the year. Whenever people bring us kittens, we ask, where did these kittens come from? Because there's a mother cat around nearby who needs to be TNR'd. And so we'll work with these people and try to see, can we reunite kittens with mom? Is mom not around? Can we try to TNR her? Are there other cats we can TNR? Because we don't want people to just keep bringing us kittens after kittens. We really want to find a solution to the problem. And you're not going to find a solution if you're not, you know, TNRing these adult cats.
So this is the Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mutes, your host. I'm speaking with Andrea Berkich. She is the shelter manager and social media coordinator at the Cal Poly Cat Program. Give us your website in case someone is thinking right now, I need to get in touch with you.
It's catprogram.calpoly.edu. And if you have any questions whatsoever, we're here to help. We're a source of education and support in the community.
You know, I was going through your website and it seems like there's a real almost family-created atmosphere with the cats. You were talking about one of your favorite kitties that just passed on and the personality of that beautiful cat. Tell us a little bit about that atmosphere. And also, what are some cat personality things that people should know if they think about becoming a foster parent for a cat?
One aspect of the program that I didn't get a chance to talk to yet, which is personally one of my favorites, is that we also have a sanctuary. Oh. Our facility isn't just for cats coming in and out. We do have a revolving door of cats, but we also have cats that live here year round until probably the end of their lives. We call them sanctuary cats, and they're either not able to be released in our TNR program or they're not able to be adopted out. And this is usually due to behavioral issues, medical issues. It really is case by case. But we have a number of cats that they don't really have any other options other than euthanasia. And so they stay with us, and we have a really dedicated team of volunteers who care for them for every need. And the kitty that passed away recently, Dorian, he was a cat that was TNR'd, but he didn't have any teeth, so he couldn't be released for his own safety. And he lived at our shelter sanctuary. And a lot of generations of students were really dedicated to this cat. A lot of students join the program because they get a little homesick. They miss their pets at home, and pets aren't allowed on Cal Poly's campus. So they come to the program, and it's a really nice way for the students to de-stress and get to hang out around their favorite animals. And it's just great for the cats to really be diligently cared for around the clock.
So in your sanctuary program, about how many cats do you have?
It's pretty small right now. We have under 10. But we're constantly getting new cats coming in. And a lot of times our volunteers work with them to the point where they can be adoptable. And Wonderful. Then we send them to a foster home, continue socialization, and then get them into a permanent home.
Let's talk about this foster program. What are the requirements and the expectations?
So a shelter environment isn't really an ideal situation for all cats. Some cats are just very stressed or depressed there, or they just have very particular needs that can't be met. Either we don't have enough space for them and they need to be on a special diet or weight loss. There's so many reasons that a cat just isn't thriving in a shelter environment. And those cats are the ones that really need fostering. Usually our foster cats aren't really considered immediately adoptable. There is a reason why they're going to a foster home. And our fosters are essentially volunteers who dedicate their time and their love and their energy, and they open up their home to these cats. We'll supply all of the supplies needed, and we'll pay for the veterinary bills, but we do need the foster to invest their time to help this cat grow or be taken care of. We don't have too many strict requirements. We mainly just want the foster to understand, you know, there's a reason why this cat needs to be in a home. They're not necessarily perfect, but we're trying to help them as best as we can. They also need to be over 18 and have pet-friendly housing.
I noticed on your application that you want the cat usually to be inside.
Yeah, we are an indoor-only rescue. This is probably a pretty recent development. Only within the last 2 or 3 years, we decided to permanently make the switch. We really follow like the industry standards, and there's been a huge push in the animal welfare industry to keep cats strictly indoors for their own safety, but also for the well-being of the environment. A lot of people underestimate how damaging cats are. They are an invasive species, and they really do take a toll on our native population of wildlife, particularly songbirds here on the Central Coast. Cats genuinely live longer. And as a rescue, it doesn't make much financial sense for us to invest so much time and love and energy and money into a cat that probably won't live very long.
Should a person be aware that they may get a cat that may pass away in their home?
In our foster program, we do have a specific type of fostering that we call hospice fostering. And yes. These are cats that they're not doing well medically. They have some kind of terminal problem. However, they still have a really good quality of life. And we choose to foster them up until that quality of life drops and they're ready for euthanasia. It's just, it's very sad when you get a cat that you know it has something wrong, but it's still so genuinely happy to be around. And we have about 3 or 4 hospice foster cats right now. And the fosters that enter these situations, they're fully aware. We're very transparent about exactly what kind of issues the cats are dealing with. And these people are really, really, you know, emotionally strong, knowing that they're helping an animal that could pass away quickly.
I noticed on your website that you did have an application that people could fill out.
We're all run by volunteers. No one gets paid here. This is all just students and community members donating their time. We have a foster coordinator specifically for adults, another one for kittens. We have different volunteer coordinators. If you want to get involved and start volunteering at a facility, those are the people to contact. And it's all outlined on our website.
That's great. I was going to ask you if you had paid staff or volunteers, and you've
all volunteer run. All the money that we get goes directly into medical bills. Our facility, we technically rent it through the university, but we don't have to actually like physically pay rent, which is really nice. It's like a contract that was established back in the 90s when we first got it. So we're very fortunate that we have, you know, such a great facility to work with. And of course, no one gets paid. So that really helps us put all the money to supplies and veterinary care. But people have been very generous with supply donations. So it's really mainly veterinary care where the money's going. And our bills definitely are steep. We have a constant revolving door of sick cats coming in and out. We're really dedicated. As long as there are options for the cat and our veterinarians think that, you know, there are avenues for us to pursue, we'll continue treatment.
So you really can use some help in the community for donations for the medical care for the cats and other
Absolutely.
Care.
Absolutely. That's where the money is definitely needed most. And it goes directly into the local veterinary clinics that we work with. And we have really great relationships with a lot of them. They're so incredibly helpful in getting our cats where they can be medically stable enough for adoption. And we'll do a lot of blood testing and stuff just to let our adopters know exactly where these cats are medically. We tend to be the rescue that takes in the sickest cats. We take in a lot of really tough cases, and we try to give these cats a chance at a better life. We go for the ones that really don't have too many options in other shelter systems. And it really is ideal because we have so many students who want experience in the industry, and they want animal behavior experience and veterinary experience. And so these cats teach our students so much and prepare them to actually be employees in animal welfare and animal medicine. And at the same time, it's just very rewarding to work with an animal that was, you know, scheduled for euthanasia and see them make a huge turnaround and find them a really good home where they can thrive.
So has the pandemic affected the program in any way?
Oh, so much. 2020 was a very difficult year for us. A lot of the local rescues were closing, and we actually remained open. So we kind of worked overtime in many ways. Our intakes tripled, our adoption tripled. We started the neonatal kitten program. We thought we'd take probably around 50 kittens by the end of the year. We took 159. Everything just went into overdrive for us during the pandemic to try to compensate for just the feral cat boom that was going on. A lot of people were not being able to fix their pets due to the closure of a lot of veterinary clinics, especially low-cost spay-neuter clinics. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were intentionally breeding animals just to have pets to sell for people who wanted pets during the pandemic. And it really caused a huge population boom that was difficult to deal with. And one of the biggest mission statements for our organization is to just stop feline overpopulation, get the population over control. So it was a difficult time for us, but it was just a very interesting time, a great time to get a lot of fascinating experiences and just do a lot of good in the time that we had and with the resources we had.
What a program. And I'm hoping people are understanding this hard work and continual work that you've done, even through this pandemic.
Yeah, cats don't take breaks. There's no vacation when you're working with animals. They need to be cared for during winter break, spring break, summer break. We have students who will stay and take care of the cats. And we also have a lot of community members who will step in, who live locally and want to help over the holidays when we tend to be short staffed.
So could you use some more volunteers?
Yeah, we're always recruiting. We especially need more volunteers in the summer when a lot of our students are out for internships or they're heading back home. And information about volunteering is all accessible through our website if anyone is interested.
Also on the website, you have information on how to donate to the program too. Is that right?
Yes. All those supplies go back into our cats, either at the shelter itself or to foster homes or to a lot of different feral cat colonies that we continue to monitor. And practically anything can be put to good use, any brand of food, types of bedding. We're just more than happy to accept it.
So I have been talking with Andrea Berkich. She is the shelter manager and social media coordinator of the Cal Poly Cat Program. Andrea, can you give us the website again?
catprogram.calpoly.edu.
Thank you so much for your time. This is The Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host.
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.